The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined now by a man who spent 37 years on our TV screens, one of the most recognisable faces on our TV screens, and of course on the airwaves on radio as well, having done 6-1, the 9 o'clock, and then Morning Ireland more recently. Started out as a reporter on This Week programme 30 plus years ago. Brian Dobson, how are you?
I'm very well, and it's lovely to be here this morning with you, Anton.
I read you quoting Max Hastings as having said that the one thing that he worried about when it came to retirement was not knowing things. How are you dealing with not knowing things?
I'm dealing just fine with it, but you do realise you very quickly not know things. You get out of touch really very quickly. I mean, I obviously follow what's happening in politics and international affairs like a lot of other people, but the extra sense of, maybe the real story beneath the story that's been told or that can be told, you'd get disconnected from that very, very quickly. Because I was asked a few times, would I do interested in a podcast or something like that? And I thought about it a bit. First of all, I thought, no, that seems like too much of a commitment, something that has to be done every week. But also, you'd need to do the prep. You'd need to do the work. If it was in the political or current affairs area, which would be the sort of area I guess I'd work in, you'd need to be down there in Leinster House. You'd need to be talking to people. And I just did that as part of my normal everyday working life for all those years in RTE. So you just pick up information by osmosis, don't you? Some of it, as you know, as a journalist, you can use, you can broadcast. Other stuff, you have to keep working at it to be able to stand it up.
Yeah, there's anything that is begun with begins with the sentence, well, obviously we can't print this, but what I'm hearing, I'm intrigued by your route into broadcasting, because a lot of your peers would have gone print first, yeah, Broadcasting second. You didn't. You weren't print, were you?
Yeah, I had an ambition to work anywhere in journalism, and I applied to the then only journalism second level course in the country, which was in the Rathmines College of Commerce, now part of TU, Technological University of Dublin, and I didn't get in. And I didn't get in because it wasn't points or anything like that. It was all that sort of period. So you had to have a certain number of honours in your leaving cert, as it used to be called. And you had to have an honour in English. And even though I tried twice over 2 years, I failed to get an honours level grade in English. Possibly because my spelling is absolutely atrocious. I am somebody who gives thanks every day for spell check. So anyway, I
because of all of the things that people must assume about you is that the quality of your... I mean, every picture I see of you at home, you are surrounded by books.
Well, I can read and I'm literate. and I can.
You
I
just
can
can't spell.
Although when I was in national school at a very early stage, I was held back a year because my reading really wasn't up to scratch. Now, that might be because I was 3 years old when I went to school. I mean, I was October birthday, but I went before. So I was probably just really not able to cope with it at that age. So I was held back, which was a bit traumatic, I recall at the time. I was held back, I think, from going from third to fourth or second to third or something like that. So, and you know, one of my teachers in secondary school suggested to my parents at a parent-teacher, meeting that maybe I might be dyslexic. Now, I think dyslexia is a serious condition and people struggle with it, and I don't really want to compare myself in that sort of a challenge that somebody would have in their life. But I was always a reader. And from very early on, I loved those Ladybird books and anything I could get my hands on, particularly history. I mean, I've always had an interest in that.
Did you write as well?
No, not very much. I got involved in a youth organisation. We did a magazine which I edited. And then in school, I was in transition year. I was in a transition year pilot programme, and we produced a radio program, and I wasn't the presenter of it. I was on the back room team, as it were. I was on the other side of the glass,
where the real work is done,
where the people make all the really important decisions. I did that, and that kind of, I suppose, just kind of planted the seed and broadcasting. And then, you know, like anybody in school, I had different ambitions at different times. But I'd certainly, by the time I got to sixth year, I'd settled on journalism. I say I tried to get into the course there in Rathmines, didn't get that. But I got into the communications course, which was more broad media, television, radio, film production, which probably was in the end better for me in the sense it gave me a broader grounding in some of those techniques and skills. Yeah.
And then it was Nova and BBC, isn't that right?
Pirate radio, yeah. Well, a little pirate radio station called Southside Radio, which was located in a hotel called the Hotel Victor out in Dunleary in South Dublin. And it was literally in a shed. And when it rained, the rain came through the roof. So I did a little bit of summer work there. And then I got a job on Radio Nova, which was quite a big and at the time very successful pirate radio station. And then I got a job in the BBC in Belfast, in Radio Ulster. Yeah, there's a kind of story behind that. I don't know. I've told
give it
times,
to us.
I had been approached about being recruited by RTE, and Leo Enright was putting together a team of people for 2FM News, and he wanted to hire me. It was a recruitment process, but there was no money at the time. So he said, and there's a couple of others involved. He said, look, I'll get back to you when we get a bit of cash. It's very it's still the same in RTE, really. And he got the cash, but he said, I can't hire you because the powers that be in RTE won't allow us hire a pirate, and which was ironic given all the DJs that had come in at that time into 2FM or Radio 2 as it was called. And but Leo recommended me to one of the editors of the BBC in Belfast and said you should meet this guy. I wanted to hire him, I couldn't, and they hired me. Yeah,
you must have been very unusual at the time in being speech pirate. Because when we think about pirates, we do think of the Ian Dempsey's, the Tony Fentons, the Jerry Ryans. It was all spinning the wheels of steel and doing music programs.
No, I never did any of that. I wouldn't have much music knowledge or anything like that. No, I was a bit of a news nerd. Yeah, in a very, very much a music driven environment. But it was great fun. And you had that sense of, I suppose, you know, there was the whiff of, you know, illegality. Well, they were illegal, but they weren't illegal in the sense that they were businesses. That were set up properly, they paid their taxes, we were on a proper payroll arrangement. I mean, everything in Nova was except they didn't have a license.
And you could get raided. There were raids on occasion.
It was in 1983, there was a big raid of all the pirate stations. They were all put off the air by the then Fine Gael government. Jim Mitchell, who I used to meet later years and rib him about it, because it was such a public outcry. People were out in the streets protesting, and the government, I think, took fright, and the pirates came back on the air, and they were left alone. But I think it did accelerate the process towards licensing and regularizing commercial radio, which, you know, so I kind of feel the pirates, well, I do believe definitely the pirates played a very important role in creating the diverse radio environment we have today. Local radio, yourselves, the commercial sector, it would exist. I mean, it was unsustainable that you would have a monopoly like RTE's.
It wouldn't have had the same ready-made cohort of talent available to it, nor would the fledgling 2FM, nor would much of Radio 1, RTE. I mean, the pirates blooded a lot of people who became very significant.
Well, very definitely. And I mean, at that time, other than the pirates, it was RTE, and that was it. And they, you know, RTE recruited recruited, but not in big numbers, obviously. So, you know, some people would get jobs there, but most of us who had ambitions to work in broadcasting really had no alternative. That's where and it was about flying hours. We were just on the air and building up the experience. And that was a big plus when I went to the BBC and they met me and interviewed me, that I had all that experience, that, you know, I'd been working in the business, if you like, for a couple of years at that stage.
Do we read anything into your willingness to toy with risk that you worked somewhere that you could have been raided at any moment? Is there a...
No,
is there a thrill-seeking bit to Brian?
No, I think just that was what was available, you know. And there's another aspect to it as well. I mean, I sometimes wonder what my parents made of all of this. You know, why can't you go and get a proper job? But there weren't really very many proper jobs. So there was a kind of, and right through the 80s, and it was a terrible decade in Ireland economically. It was great in other ways, but economically it was a terrible decade. And so that gives a kind of freedom. So people got involved in pirate radio, or got involved in the arts, or got involved in community groups, or, you know, or maybe set up their own business. So, you know, because there wasn't a conventional job career route available to large numbers, or there was emigration, of course, which was taking place on a huge scale there. So I think that was really, and I was 20 or 21. I mean, I was very young. You don't really think about the future at that stage.
You know, you were also very young when you got the big gig in RTE. You were presenting 6-1 in when you were 30, 31?
I was presenting, yeah. I think it was initially it was the news at the TV 1 o'clock news. Then I worked on the 9, and then the 6-1 was a few years after that. Yeah, so I was a mainstream, if you like, news anchor, presenting the main bulletins at about the age of 31, yeah. I sometimes wonder what would happen today, and probably not. But it wasn't unusual. One of the people who done it before me was Richard Crowley, who was about my age. People may remember Richard from Morning Ireland. And Richard had been presenting the main TV bulletins a couple of years beforehand in his 20s, I think.
So funny, because I would have thought it would be the opposite, that there was a sense that there had to be grey-haired gravitas to present the news in the 80s and 90s. But no, young people were given a shot.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I mean, and RTE had that mix of people who'd been there and had experience. And that was the great thing about working in that news environment, that there were lots of people around who had been around and really, you know, knew their onions and, you know, could give very good advice and steady the ship and, you know, maybe haul in some of our more exuberant ideas from time to time, you know, and no harm in that. But yeah, I got an early break. Charlie Bird, my late great pal, used to say that I peaked too early.
A lot of people, obviously, when you announced your retirement, asked you about the high points, the most significant interviews. Can I ask the other side of things? Did you have any good disasters?
I don't know. I had a few near disasters over the years, but you see, I think what happens is that you put those out of your mind, don't you?
Oh God, no! I dwell on mine. I told you about the one before we came on air where I forgot somebody's name. One of the ones that still, it's now, it must be 15 years ago. I announced, it's a long backstory that I won't give you, but I announced a woman as pregnant live on air who wasn't.
Okay, well, I can't match that, I'm afraid. I was sent to South Africa for the election of Nelson Mandela for the in 1994. And this was the first time that RT had, well, I think it was the first time, as far as I'm aware, the first time RT had sent a news anchor, a presenter, to a big international story to broadcast live. So I was going to be broadcasting live through the couple of days, whatever. It turned out being a couple of weeks because the election was extended and so on. But anyway, I am for the first night, and we were working with the European Broadcasting Union, which is an association of European broadcasters, and they were providing a satellite, satellite connection. RTE couldn't afford its own satellite. In fact, a lot of broadcasters couldn't. So we would share with the Danes and the Dutch and that, and you all had your little slot. And we had our booking. And I went up the first night to do my broadcast. And I was always terrible. And the directors in RTE will tell you this. I come into the studio at the last moment, you know, 5 to 6. Where's Dabo? And I'm here now. And everybody, and I used to try and be more disciplined, and then it would slip back again. So anyway, so I was busy because I was writing scripts for this broadcast. And I was more or less on my own when Sean O'Rourke was with me as he was doing radio. So we were kind of backing each other up. So anyway, typical enough, I went up on the roof to do this thing it was about 8 floors up from where we were in the broadcasting headquarters of the South African broadcaster in Johannesburg. Dark, late 9 o'clock news, I think, back here in Ireland. And I got up on the roof at about 5 to 9 or 10 to 9 o'clock, and there's nobody there. It's complete pitch dark. There's no cameras set up. There's no lights. There's nothing. And I mean, Archie has spent a lot of money getting us there, booking these slots. And I know my boss back home, if he doesn't see me on the TV at 9 o'clock that night, there's going to be hell to pay. But I didn't have time to go back down to the control room at this stage, you know. So this, I was getting a lesson in why you should be there in good time. And I happened to see a couple of guys sort of sitting having a cigarette in the corner of the roof space. And I said, guys, you know, we don't know anything about you. And I said, I'm on the air in 5 minutes. Is my position here? Where's it? So I said, okay, we'll see what we can do. So they kind of in a leisurely way got up, you know, and started fiddling with cameras and flicking them on, put on some lights. And I stood there. I had my scripts are shaking in my hand, and they kind of tilted the camera up and pointed at me and pushed a button, and a little light came on. And then I heard a voice in my ear saying, RT. Okay, ready, standing by. Then the music comes on and it's hello, good evening, and welcome from Johannesburg. So I made it by the skin of my teeth. And what had happened was the booking had got lost somewhere in the ether, and everyone was sitting around in the control room thinking the day was over, their task was done. And the camera came on, pointed at me in the light, and someone said, that's RT.
And the first they knew of it is they see their guy on the telly.
So that was pretty close. I'm not sure my career would have prospered after that. That had gone the wrong way.
You've said a couple of times about the quality of people that you worked with, and that phrase of thoughtful and reflective. Are you despairing of what's happened in recent years in terms of news media? I don't mean in terms of the core broadcasters, but the fact now that you have so much disinformation around, so much misinformation around, so many people given platforms when you don't see the thoughtfulness or considered reflection on the stories that they are ostensibly covering.
Well, it's funny because the way news media current affairs coverage has evolved, it's gone in sort of two separate, nearly contradictory directions. As you say, on the one hand, there's this kind of instant outrage or, you know, whipping up false, you know, fake news, whatever it is. I mean, on the other hand, you have the development of these long-form broadcasts and podcasts, which are you know, really, I mean, they're not innovative. There was always that kind of journalism around, but it's now become popular. It's become embedded. People are committing themselves to listen to podcasts week after week where they are reflective and thoughtful, and they're challenging, and they are, you know, they're often come from a particular point of view, but they do inject some balance and fairness and objectivity into their coverage. So I think it's kind of an interesting contrast. So I don't despair. I know a lot of, you know, outrage over whatever might be the issue of the day is driven by social media. But I think there's still quite a lot of trust in traditional legacy media in this country. And I think that's, you know, clear from the numbers of people who watch and listen and even still buy or subscribe to newspapers. So I think people are looking for information they can trust. A lot of people are looking for information they can trust. There's high levels of trust, according to surveys, in what, you know, you do here at News Talk, what RTE does. You know, people do turn to trusted sources. And we used to find, if I go back to the TV days and 6-1 days, on a big story, we would see a definite spike in our audience, you know, because people would, we felt, I mean, I'm making some assumptions here, but we felt people were turning to RTE in that case because of what is actually going on here. This is something that's important. I mean, a lot of the time, people live their lives, and I've begun to realize this now that I'm not in the business. You know, you don't need to be following every twist and turn of every news story every day. So you pay attention more at certain times than other times. And obviously at the moment, there's lots of reasons to pay very close attention. And then, of course, you reach the point where it becomes all a bit overwhelming and you really maybe just need to take a break. And I used to always advise people during some periods, you know, COVID or whatever it might be, just take a break from the news. It doesn't do any harm just to give your head a rest. And I used to do it myself occasionally.
Now, this weekend, of course, is momentous because on Friday, your former colleague, Joe Duffy, hung up his spurs on Liveline. You now, how long into retirement at this point?
It was May last year, so that's 14 months, is it?
Yeah, so you've crossed the year-long threshold of retirement.
Yeah, yeah.
From what you have learned, what is your advice to Joe on his first weekend of freedom?
Well, I wouldn't offer any advice to Joe. I pass on a bit of advice that was given to me when I retired. I happened to have, around that time in for interview, Enda Kenny. And Enda, of course, had retired as Taoiseach some time before.
You're not going to grow a beard and start cycling, are you?
No. I've never grown a beard. I don't think I'd be allowed to. I do cycle already. But his advice was not to make any commitments for about 6 months. And just to take some time to yourself and think about things and maybe then get involved. Because, you know, there'll be all kinds of offers. And I said, Enda, you know, you're a former Taoiseach. Of course there's lots of offers. Nobody's going to be offering me anything. But actually, the phone did start to ring, you know, maybe not the sort of things that Enda might be offered, but, you know, would you like to get involved in this or that? And by and large, I sort of just held back and kicked to touch. And I think that was a good bit of advice. And I mean, Joe will have any number of people looking for him to get involved in this or that or the other. And, you know, so just maybe pause on that. And the other piece of advice that was given to me by a friend of mine was when you retire, there's three questions you should never ask your spouse. Where are you going? What time will you be back? And can I come with you?
You obviously have been, you may have been selective, but you have taken a couple of things that have been offered to you. You've taken the chairmanship of the Commission on Commemoration.
Commemorations Advisory Committee, to give it its proper title. And it's on
statues and busts and plaques.
No, more.
Worth a shot.
more events and activities that commemorate events. I mean, we all know we had the decade of commemoration there of centenaries in the last
parades.
Parades and yeah, I'm not sure. Like, at this stage, it's early stages. So the way it works is they've asked our committee, of which is I'm chair, independent chair, to give me my proper title, of which I'm chair, to give a view on proposals that will come forward. So in the Department of Communications, Culture and Sport, there is a unit, a commemorations unit, and they'll be developing ideas for commemorations, marking. A lot of it would be the early years of the Free State, so it's really about nation building, some of the events around that. You know, the ESB was founded, the Ardna Crusher work started, or N2, which was the precursor of RTE, was founded. You know, events like that, and then later you have the Catholic Emancipation, which would be a 200th anniversary of that. Daniel O'Connell's 250th birth is coming up this year. So there's already events planned in relation to that. So it's to look at some of the proposals for commemorations and just see, do they meet the criteria of being, you know, respectful, inclusive, measured, based
on interesting gig.
So it is interesting. Yeah. And I'm looking forward, because I am a history buff, and I firmly believe you to understand the present, you really have to understand something of your history. But the other thing is that actually history is never about the past, really. It's about the present. And people have strong views about commemoration and how events should be commemorated and how we should look back on some of the formative events in the early years of this state. And so this is a committee of wise people who will look at proposals, who will be invited to bring forward their own proposals, and who will ensure that whatever whatever happens is respectful and inclusive and appropriate.
And despite only being out of the place a wet week, you're back on the telly.
Yes, that's right. Towards the end of last year, I was approached by an independent production company, Scratch Films, and asked would I be involved in a documentary which they had been commissioned by Commissioner Mion to be broadcast on RTE about Ireland's missionary priests and nuns. So it's the last missionaries, I think is the title, because of course it's a declining number of people still in the field. And so I was filming that between the end of last year and early into this year. Dervla MacDonald, who you know, the journalist, is also involved in it. So there's sort of two of us doing the work on it.
Must have been some fascinating stories from that.
Fascinating, yeah. It's quite a story. I think people are going to be intrigued to hear it. And there can hardly be a community or even maybe a family in Ireland, a Catholic family, this is about the Catholic missionary story, that that doesn't have an aunt or an uncle or somebody who they know was on the missions, you know. So we've uncovered lots of fascinating stories, and that's been broadcast on the 14th of July, and again, there's two parts on the 21st.
Brian, thank you very much. That, of course, the one and only Brian Dobson.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is on at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,000 store-wide with our lifetime price guarantee and 100% comfort guarantee. Why shop anywhere else? Limited time clearance savings only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com.